morning, Patriots. Today, we're going to do Federalist Paper number 71. Man, we're getting through these. It's been a long number of months, but we're getting near the end of the Federalist Papers. Before we begin, let's remind ourselves, everyone, of the Slipper Revolution, which we're going to celebrate on the 27th of August. And the way to celebrate, be part of that, is to get yourself a pair of My Slippers. We're doing that as a thank you to Mike Lindell and his great company at MyPillow for all the dedication he's given to this nation, and at the same time boosting his sales with Patriot Love dollars and trying to reclaim that $65 million that cancel culture left has stripped from his company's revenues. We can do that by having patriots around the world buy a million pairs of My Slippers. So if you go to MyPillow.com and you use the BARDS code, B-A-R-D-S, that's the promo code, you'll get some nice savings on everything from pillows, 66% off on pillows, sheets, comforters, and you can get yourself a pair of My Slippers with 40% off on that. When you do that, you're part of the Slipper Revolution. And we're going to bring those sales back to MyPillow. Cancel the cancel left, which makes me happy just saying it. And we're waging war appropriately, just as our colonists did. We're using our dollars as a mechanism to choose the type of forces of leadership and success and commerce that we want in our society. So get yourself a pair of My Slippers and join the Slipper Revolution. You can pick up, like I said, My sheets are amazing, by the way. My pillows, awesome. My comforter, crazy good. So get on over there. MyPillow.com. MyPillow.com. BARDS, the promo code BARDS, B-A-R-D-S. You can also call 800-975-2939. 800-975-2939. So today's Federalist Paper, the duration in office of the executive. It's Federalist Paper number 71. In these days that we're in right now, we are in the days that are focused a lot on the executive, the theft of the election that happened on November 3rd and 4th, this coup that's been happening right before us. Not just a coup by the executive, but a coup by our entire government. Involvement of people from every echelon of government. Senate, House, intelligence agencies, military members. Unbelievable amount of corruption and deceit and treason to this nation. Selling out to blackmail and selling out to money and promises of power, globalist intentions, all driven around the concept of destroying the Constitution. Our founding fathers put in within our Constitution checks and balances, and we've learned that through 70 papers. And the checks and balances are not that complicated, but they are extremely effective as long as we as a nation adhere to them. The first and primary check and balance is that this country is built on moral law. That means that we are all accountable to God. So let's put this a different way. If you're going to be in government and you don't believe in God, you're in the wrong place. Because with that also comes inalienable rights. So that means that if you're going to be in government and you don't believe in God-given rights, you can't serve in government. That's my opinion, but it needs to be there. It means that people can't take away your rights by saying, like, you didn't get a shot, so you can't have your rights. That doesn't happen in the Constitution. That happens in the world of fools and of sheeple and of the ignorant. The Constitution never says that, doesn't allow that. And there's no provisions to override that. Whatever corrupt court system tries to tell you that, well, in case of emergency, there's no in case of emergency in God-given rights. Period. We also have another part of the Constitution that's a check and balance. And that is we the people. It's the fundamental aspect to this government, which our founding fathers returned to as a republican form of government that has nothing to do with parties, by the way. A republican form of government is a government that is run by the people. Democrats need to call themselves something else, like donkey butt or tyrants or racist. That's probably all three of those you could call. Well, I guess that's what a Democrat means, so I guess they have the right name after all. Straight up dirtbags, I'm telling you. But they're not for the people. They're for a consolidation of power in their own. So our focus has to be the restoration of people's will and understanding that this government doesn't function unless they're actively involved. That means participative government. Our elected officials, 2 years in the House, 6 years in the Senate, 4 years for the president, all done strategically to create a check and balance within the system of governance and an accountability to the people. The House, they represent our regions, most local to our living areas. Those positions are cycled every 2 years. It isn't just I like him because he's a Democrat. Anybody in America that votes by party line, straight party line, without thinking about what your vote is doing, as far as I'm concerned, you're a traitor to the Constitution. If your vote ends up being by party line because you have paid attention to every single person and what they represent truly, not the promises of the free stuff, going to give you a phone, but if truly what their content is, then you're doing something. And that's a part of looking at every position each time that we vote, becoming informed, engaged. That's part of the cost of citizenry in this United States. We love our military. We love to outsource our freedom. Let some other guy go over across the lands and kill the bad guys so that we can live happy and go through McDonald's drive-thru and get the burger the way we want it. But it has never been free to live here. There has always been a cost to that freedom, and that freedom was supposed to be paid for on a daily basis by people's engagement, involvement in government, to be informed citizens, to uphold the Constitution and hold our elected officials accountable through our vote. That is the cost of freedom. It's not the right to buy a new car with $60,000 in debt and have 6 years to pay it off. Freedom is centered on our engagement with the society, being involved with the government, being holding them accountable, informed citizenry. So let's dig into Federalist Paper number 71. The duration in office of the executive, from the New York Packet, published on Tuesday, March 18th, 1788. The author was Alexander Hamilton. I had to add some coffee on that one. Here we go. To the people of the state of New York. Duration in office has been mentioned as the second requisite to the energy of the executive authority. This has relation in two objects: the personal firmness of the executive magistrate in the employment of his constitutional powers, and the stability of the system of administration which may have been adopted under his auspices. With regard to the first, it must be evident that the longer the duration in office, the greater will be the probability of obtaining so important an advantage. It is a general principle of human nature that a man who will be interested in whatever he possesses. Stop a minute, Patriots. I'm on the wrong paper. I said 71. We did this yesterday. Whoops, fast forward. Okay. I think we'll start with the right paper. How's that one? You were going to go like, what was going on? I thought I heard this yesterday. And you did. That was just a quick recap. Didn't want you to forget where we came from. That's all. Psych. I should have read my notes on the... It's sitting here right in chat. I'm looking at it on the upper part of the headline of chat. Federalist Paper number 72. And I'm talking about 71. So let's rewind that one. That was a test. Who passed? Oh, look at that. One of our mods, Paperbag Patriot, did. Keeping you all on your toes. That's what we're doing. Okay, so let's try this again. Federalist Paper number 72. The same subject continued. And re-eligibility of the executive considered. The New York Packet, March 21st, 1788, and by Alexander Hamilton. To the state of New York, to the people of the state of New York, the administration of government in its largest sense comprehends all the operations of the body politic, whether legislative, executive, or judiciary. But in its most usual and perhaps most precise signification, it is limited to executive details and falls peculiarly within the province of the executive department. The actual conduct of foreign negotiations, the proprietary plans of finance, the application and disbursement of the public monies in conformity to the general appropriations to legislature, the arrangement of the Army and Navy, the directions of the operations of war, these and other matters of a like nature constitute what seems to be most properly understood by the administration of government. The persons, therefore, to whose immediate management these different matters are committed ought to be considered as assistants or deputies of the chief magistrate, and on this account they ought to derive their offices from his appointment, at least from his nomination, and ought to be subject to his superintendence. This view of the subject will at once suggest to us the intimate connection between the duration of the executive magistrate in office and the stability of the system of administration. To reverse and undo what has been done by a predecessor is very often considered by a successor as the best proof he can give his own capacity and desert, and in addition to his propensity, where the alteration has been the result of public choice. The person substituted is warranted in supposing that the dismission of his predecessor has proceeded from a dislike of his measures, and that the less he resembles him, the more he will recommend himself to the favor of his constituents. These considerations and the influence of personal confidence and attachments would be likely induce a very new president to promote a change of men to fill the subordinate stations, and these causes together could not fail to occasion a disgraceful and ruinous mutability in the administration of the government, kind of like we're witnessing right now. It is such a fight. It is such a fight in Congress and in government to control the domain and undo the predecessor's rules. It gets to be stupid. It's a party fight. It's never about the intent of the nation and what's good for the nation. It's always about what's benefit for the ego of the individual. Completely ridiculous. With a positive duration of considerable extent, I connect the circumstance of re-eligibility. The first is necessary to give to the officer himself the inclination and the resolution to act his part well, and to the community time and leisure to observe the tendency of his measure, and thence to form an experimental estimate of their merits. The last is necessary to enable the people, when they see reason to approve his conduct, to approve him in his station, in order to prolong the utility of his talents and virtues, and to secure the government the advantage of permanency in a wise system of administration. Nothing appears to be more plausible at first sight, nor more ill-founded upon close inspection, than a scheme which is in relation to the present point that has had some respectable advocates. I mean that of continuing the chief magistrate in office for a certain time, and then excluding him from it, either for a limited period or forever after. The exclusion, whether temporary or perpetual, would have nearly the same effects, and these effects would be, for the most part, rather pernicious than salutary. One ill effect of the exclusion will be a diminution of the inducements of good behavior. There are few men who would not feel much less zeal in the discharge of the duty when they were conscious that the advantage of the station with which it was connected must be relinquished at a detriment period, that when they were permitted to entertain hope of obtaining or by meriting a continuance of them. This position will not be disputed so long as it is admitted that the desire of reward is one of the strongest incentives of human conduct, and that the best security for the fidelity of mankind is to make more interests coincide with their duty. Even the love of fame, the ruling passion of the noblest minds, which would promote a man to plan and undertake extensive and arduous enterprises for the public benefit, requiring considerable time to mature and perfect them, if he could not flatter himself with the prospect of being allowed to finish what he had begun, would, on the contrary, deter him from undertaking when he foresaw that he must quit the scene before he could accomplish the work, and must commit that, together with its own reputation, to hands which might be unequal or unfriendly to the task. To most to be expected from the generality of men in such a situation is that negative merit of not doing harm instead of the positive merit of doing good. A powerful insight has to do with incentive. Government is not built on incentive, but government has become built on compliance and obedience to the rules of somebody higher up. We say public servants, but when we put people in the service of the public, we expect them to take action and move forward on initiatives, and we expect them to see it through to the end. And what our founding fathers, framers, were saying is that if you take that incentive away, then you will have an issue where you will have a negative result. The people will seek to do things for their own benefit rather than the praise of accomplishing the great things for the public. At the end of the day, like it or not, we all have egos, and they're acknowledging that very boldly. That people aren't just going to do things for the good of doing things. Quite to the contrary, they're going to do things for the benefit of being rewarded in some fashion, because that's what they seek. And in so doing that, they then are going to be compelled to do great things for the public good. Another ill effect of the exclusion would be the temptation of sordid views to peculation, and in some instances to usurpation. An avaricious man who might happen to fill the office, looking forward to a time when he must at all events yield up the emolence he enjoyed, would feel a propensity not easy to be resisted by such a man to make the best use of the opportunity he enjoyed while it lasted, and might not scruple to have recourse to the most correct expedients to make the harvest as abundant as it was transitory. Though the same man, probably with a different prospect before him, might content himself with the regular perquisites of his situation, and might even be unwilling to risk the consequence of an abuse of his opportunities. His avarice might be a guard upon his avarice. Add to this, the same man might be vain and ambitious as well as avaricious. And if he could expect to prolong his honors by the good conduct, he might hesitate to sacrifice his appetite for his appetite for grain. But when the prospect before him of approaching an inevitable annihilation, his avarice would be likely to get the victory over his caution, his vanity, or his ambition. In other words, if you take away his opportunity to have ambition and to gain recognition for it, he's going to be more inclined to do things for his own benefit and not necessarily for the public good. So it's a continuation of this argument. An ambitious man, too, will be found when he found himself seated on the summit of the country's honors, when he looked forward to the time at which he must descend from the exalted eminence of ever or forever, and reflected that no exertion of merit on his part could save him from the unwelcome reverse, such a man in such situation would become more violently tempted to embrace a favorable conjuncture for attempting the proclamation of his power. At every personal hazard, then, if he had the probability of answering the same end by doing his duty, would it promote the peace of the community or the stability of government to have a dozen men who had had credit enough to be raised to the seat of the supreme magistracy? That word gets me every time. Magistracy. There it is. Wandering among the people like disconnected ghosts and sighting for a place which they were destined never more to possess. A third ill effect of the exclusion would be the depriving of the community of the advantage of the experience gained by the chief magistrate in the exercise of his office. That experience is the parent of wisdom, is an adage the truth in of which is recognized by the wisest, as well as simplest mankind. What more desirable and more essential than this quality than governs in the governors of nations? Where more desirable and more essential than in the first magistrate of a nation, can it be wise to put the desirable or essential quality under the ban of the Constitution and to declare that the moment it is acquired, its possessors shall be compelled to abandon the station in which it was acquired and to which it is adopted? This, nevertheless, is the precise import of those regulations which exclude men from the serving of their country by the choice of their fellow citizens, after they have, by a course of service, fitted themselves for doing it with greater degree of utility. A fourth effect of exclusion would be the banishing of men from stations in which, in certain emergencies of state, their presence might be the greatest moment of the public interest and safety. There is no nation which has not, at one period or another, experienced an absolute necessity of the services of a particular man in particular situations. Perhaps it would not be too strong to say the preservation of its political existence. How unwise, therefore, must be every such self-denying ordinance as serves to prohibit a nation from making use of its own citizens in a manner best suited to its exigencies and circumstances. Without supposing the personal essentiality of the man, it is evident that the change of the chief magistrate at the breaking out of war or at any similar crisis for another, even of equal merit, would at all times be detrimental to the community, in as much as would be substitute inexperience to experience, and would tend to unhinge and set afloat the already settled train of the administration. A fifth ill effect of exclusion would be that it would operate as a constitutional interdiction of stability in the administration. By necessitating a change of men in the first office of the nation, it would necessitate a mutability of measures. It is not generally to be expected that men will vary and measures remain uniform. The contrary is the usual course of things, and as we need to be apprehensive that there will be too much stability while there is even the option of changing, nor need we desire to prohibit the people from continuing their confidence where they think it may be safely placed, and whereby constancy on their part, they may obviate the fatal inconvenience of fluctuating councils and various policy. These are some of the disadvantages which would flow from the principles of exclusion. They apply most forcibly to the scheme of a perpetual exclusion. But when we consider that even a partial exclusion would always render the readmission of the persons a remote and precarious object, the observations which have been made will apply nearly as fully to one case as the other. Okay, I'm going to recap some of that because this is a really important discussion that centers on a different way of seeing our government than what we see today. All of those exclusions we're talking about, once people served, that they couldn't serve again. From the president to limiting him in a way that basically said that people couldn't re-elect him, that he wouldn't be able to win the confidence of the people to complete his process. Think about what just happened with President Trump. The people unanimously re-elected him. The system stole it from the people. The point of this is this. We re-elected him to complete what he started. That's what we wanted him to do. Complete what he started. And so there's a balance here of establishing term limits and allowing people to have the free will of choice. And this is what they're talking about. They're also talking about party politics. And this is really key to this. Understand that George Washington was absolutely against parties. So are many other of our framers. And in doing that, what we are dealing with here in party politics is there's always a pendulum swing of vengeance sort of thing. Democrats have the office one time, so they're going to push as many policies forward on their agenda. Pendulum swings to Republicans. They do their kabuki theater. They gut the government of all their people, and they put their people in. There shouldn't be that sort of swing in the constitutional government. The Constitution does not have such a wide latitude of swing that we start to see policies going from leftist to elitist. It doesn't work that way. When you're centered on the Constitution, everything has a swing to some degree or another based on priorities. But when you are based on the Constitution, there are certain things that will not happen. You're not going to institute a UBI, a universal basic income, if you're working on the Constitution. You're not going to make some fallacious claim that health care is a human right, which is pure nonsense. You're not going to change the entire policies of government to fight fake climate science. This engine that has been created has become so politicized in every aspect that it is a constant pendulum swing from one party to the other. So there is what's built into that? The key control mechanism that they use on every single thing and how they've subjugated our Constitution to their will is the pendulum of fear. You fear getting one person. They've done a brilliant job at it. You fear having a Democrat in office if you're a Republican. You fear having a Republican office if you're in office if you're a Democrat. And the greatest part of this fool's game is the Democrats and the Republicans are all part of one party. It's called globalism. With the exception of a handful of people, and there are just a handful of people. It's called globalism. Okay? Continuing. What are the advantages promised to counterbalance these disadvantages? They are represented to be, first, greater independence in the magistrate, second, greater security to the people. Unless the exclusion be perpetual, there will be no pretense to infer in the first advantage. But when the case may be, but even in that case, may he have no object beyond his present station to which he may sacrifice his independence? May he have no connections, no friends for whom he may sacrifice it? May he not be less willing by a firm conduct to make personal enemies when he acts under the impression that a time is is fast approaching on the arrival at which he may only but must be exposed by the resentments upon an equal, perhaps upon an inferior footing. It is not an easy point to determine whether his independence would be most promoted or impaired by such an arrangement. Essentially, what we're saying here is if you start to impede people too much, they are not going to serve the government. They're going to serve their self-interest because they're going to preserve their goals because they didn't get a chance to fulfill their mission. They're going to start putting in, it's going to become cronyism. It sounds familiar. That's where we are. So one of the things that has come out of this Federalist Paper number 72 is one of the most abhorred elements of our government, and it's the SES class, Senior Executive Service. This SES class is not elected. It is put in station for in perpetuity, literally. Someone gets as an SES, you can't fire them. They're protected by unions. They have a secure class in government, and they're extremely influential. They were argued to be the stability factor of one administration to another. In fact, they have become a force in themselves to steer government, make policy, and steal the power from the Constitution and the people. If there is one class of people that absolutely needs to be eliminated, and I mean outrightly removed, cored out, never allowed to exist again in government, it is the SES class. They are worthless in the end. They are a threat to democracy. They are perpetual federal employees. They produce nothing. And they sustain consistency within politics and views in which they hold to, which are not representative of the people. They are truly parasites of the worst kind. Last two paragraphs. As to the second supposed advantage, there is still greater reason to entertain doubts concerning it. If the exclusion were to be perpetual, a man of irregular ambition, of whom alone there could be reason in any case to entertain apprehension, would with infinite reluctance yield to the necessity of taking his leave forever of a post in which his passion for power and preeminence had acquired the force of habit. And if he had been fortunate or adroit enough to conciliate the goodwill of the people, he might induce them to consider as a very obvious and unjustifiable restraint upon themselves a provisions which was calculated to debar them of the right of giving a fresh proof of their attachment to a favorite. There may be conceived circumstances in which this disgust of the people seconding the thwarted ambition of such favorite might occasion greater danger to liberty than could ever reasonably be dreaded from the possibility of a perpetuation in office by the voluntary suffrage of the community exercising a constitutional privilege. That paragraph, last two sentences, is directly written towards these parasites called the SES class. There is an excess of refinement in the idea of disabling the people to continue in office, men who had entitled themselves, in their opinion, to the approbation and confidence, the advantages of which are best speculative and equivocal and overbalanced by the disadvantages far more certain and decisive. Publius, end of paper number, Federalist Paper number 72. Continuity of government is a big issue, and it's a big issue especially in a republic that's a representative form of government where the president is only on station for 4 years. The size of the government now is so immense by the proportion to what it was that it's nearly impossible for a president to come in and not be influenced by malicious intents of people around him. There's thousands of positions to fill. One of the first steps in restoring our government is to get rid of the size of the government, to downsize it, reduce it, make it smaller. It has to be manageable like a small company, not a massive behemoth corporation that has no control. The other big issue is that we must get rid of the senior executive class. And this kind of idea that you can, once you get into these positions, you can't be removed. It's one thing to limit exclusion, which is what that number 72 is about. If we aren't careful, exclusion becomes a negative because you tell somebody, well, you can come in and have 4 years. And at the end of that, you might be doing great things. And they're like, nah, we don't care. You're not part of our party. Out you go. So what are you going to do? The motive of men is to become devious. You'll find a replacement for yourself. You'll influence. You'll do things. And it becomes this kind of interesting warfare that happens within government. And that's exactly what we have evolved to, or de-evolved to. And part of that problem is the size of the government program, or the government itself. The SES class was designed by name to create a stability in the continuance of government. Continuity of government, so that they were able to bridge from one administration to the next without the concern of being removed, so that certain functions in government could perpetuate themselves without being politically influenced. The problem is that the SES class has become a political force themselves. And as increasingly higher numbers of them are of a liberal mindset and influenced by their own selfish desires in positions that produce nothing for society. They're self-justified positions, positions that they will proclaim to be of super importance to the world, which they're not. They're all taxpayer servants, and they forget that. There are no easy answers in this space of exclusion and perpetuation in government. Where to draw that line? And our founding fathers alluded to that. One of the biggest things that we come back to is when you strip away, and this is where we begin today's discussion, where you strip away the aspects of moral law to where no one's accountable to government. They're only accountable to themselves. And you then have the attitude that the people are lesser than you, that you are superior to them because of your education, where you come from, the position in which you hold, the title in which you're insured. The SES class become like many kings. This is why they need to be removed. We cannot have a class of people that can move on infinitely in government and then building a good old boy program and a system of nepotism that allows them to seize control of the government from within. They must be neutered and removed permanently. At the same time, we don't want to exclude people so severely that when you need expertise from a previous reign of power, that you can't pull them in, or people that have done service in other areas that you can't pull them in. Either way, this is all very dangerous. And it's when you start to get into this area of perpetuation of power. And especially when you add that layer of ideologies of party, which are nonsense, the only philosophy that binds us is In God We Trust. We have differences, but we have to be educated on the Constitution. And we, the people, have to understand that there are certain things that can't exist under our Constitution as it is written now. You can't be a communist and run under this Constitution for any office. That idea is completely nonsense. The idea that you can be a communist and run for office is absolutely wrong. You can't, Bernie Sanders. You can't be a fascist and run for office. It's not part of what goes on here. You can't be a hand puppet of a foreign government. Barack Hussein Obama, Joe Biden. See, these things are all excluded by definition of how the Constitution was designed to function. But over the years, this elite class has manipulated the legal arguments to justify everything, and then they've spun it in the public eye to where it seems normal. It's like, well, of course it's normal. We can have all these political parties and we can have communists running. No, you can't. Because communists don't believe in inalienable rights. That's where it begins. And when you understand the structure of our government, from moral law to the rule of law, and the accountability to the people and the accountability to God, right away you've excluded a whole bunch of people intentionally. And therein, you find the whole corruption and collusion that begins to happen. Government itself begins to defend itself, and it becomes an alien body to the public. The government is by and for the people, not the government ruling over the people. And that major reset has to happen in order for us to succeed in this republic reset. And most importantly, above all of that, is we have to get back to the fundamentals of who we are ultimately accountable. Every single one of us, without exception, is accountable to God. So if you come from a society which does not believe in the Judeo-Christian ethics, I'm sorry, but if in my read of the Constitution and my belief in this country, you cannot participate in American politics. If you come from India, I use this because corporations are using people from India all the time. I respect who you are, but you lack an understanding if you are still rooted in your beliefs in India of inalienable rights. You come from a class-based society where you literally accept that there is a lower and subclass in your world. That does not happen in America. Therefore, unless you are willing to embrace the full sense of what the Constitution is, you cannot be in a position of power in this country. If you're an American corporation hiring Indians, which they do, corporate America, running social media, corporate America, dictating freedom of speech policies, Silicon Valley, it's done so intentionally. These people are not qualified to manage the rights of the Constitution. If you're Indian and you're offended by that, suck it up. Read the Constitution and either become us or them. But in America, you're either American or you're not. There's no in between. There's no 50-50 American here. This is the whole key here. Everything pivots back to inalienable rights. And that pivots to the Judeo-Christian ethics on which this country was built upon. And if you can't get that in your heart, I think China's taken entry-level people, if you want to like crawl over there or something. I mean, this is the where the war is, patriots. And it has to be an uncompromising war here. And if we can't get this right, we're not going to reset this nation. There are some that can run. There are some that can't participate in government. It's that fundamentally simple. I don't care if who you are. If you can't embrace the Constitution for what it is, you do not belong in governance, period. End of story. So that's our fight. And it's a big one. And it's a demanding one. And it's where the world is watching to see if America has the backbone to do what's right, to reset its own constitution, which is the constitution that gives hope to the world. Let us pray. Heavenly Father, we're blessed in this time to be here. We're blessed in this wisdom that is passed on by our framers and the wisdom that you place within our hearts. We ask that you'll guide us, protect us, open our eyes to see, continue to let us hear the truths that are around us, to use this wisdom as we step forward to reset this nation back to moral law, the love of you and accountability to you in all things, and the power back to the people, to have a government truly by and for the people and on the foundations of the true meaning of In God We Trust. We say these things in Christ's holy name. Amen. Okay, so I hope you have a very blessed day. I'll see you this evening for Bards FM. We have a great interview tonight with Jim Meehan, a brilliant mind in the fight to keep humanity alive and away from this bioweapon that they're being injected in them. I think you'll enjoy it very much. He's also going to speak at Bards Fest, so it'll be a great interview. So keep your head up and your eyes forward. Never bow to evil, never relent. Always press into the fight. Prayers up. We are going to win this fight through truth and knowledge. God will never forsake us. He'll never leave us. And in the end, God will always win. Let's use our brain as he gave us for something other than a pillow. It's time that we dig in, get to know these things, understand our Constitution, understand what this fight is about, gain the knowledge that God intends us to have. And in the end, get out here and fight with faith in our hearts in all things. So I'll see you tonight or until the next time. God bless and out for now.
We shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and the success of liberty.
Every thoughtful citizen who despairs of war and wishes to bring peace should begin by looking inward, by examining his own attitude towards the possibilities of peace. Too many of us think it is impossible. Too many think it is unreal. But that is a dangerous, defeatist belief. It leads to the conclusion that war is inevitable, that mankind is doomed, that we are gripped by forces we cannot control. We need not accept that view. Our problems are man-made, therefore they can be solved by man, and man can be as big as he wants. No problem of human destiny is beyond human beings. Man's reason and spirit have often solved the seemingly unsolvable, and we believe they can do it again. Surely the opening vistas of space promise high costs and hardships, as well as high reward. So it is not surprising that some would have us stay where we are a little longer, to rest, to wait. But this city of Houston, this state of Texas, this country of the United States was not built by those who waited and rested and wished to look behind them. This country was conquered by those who move forward, and so will space. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept.
The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Has waited thousands of years to show its face. It has only one intent, to destroy God's light and to enslave. It has no scruples. It has no rules but one, to win at any cost. But we will never bow, for we are the remnant that will hold the line. This is war. We fight. We push, we climb, we never give in. We become the nightmare that evil didn't know could exist. We pray, we stand. We live by the words, "In God we trust." We fear nothing. We are the light that can never be extinguished.
We are patriots. We are the digital army that will help deliver God's wrath.